Hello, I'm Oliver Wong. Flying solo this week, Morgan Rhodes will be back next time. You are listening to Heat Rocks. Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, you know, hot lava on wax. And today, we'll be raising it up by getting down with an album celebrating its 20th anniversary this year, the debut of Detroit's Slum Village, Fantastic Volume 2.
Yo, what's up? Yo, check it out. This is Fantastic Volume 2.
Yeah.
Yo, I'm T3.
Yo, what up? It's JD.
It's Botan. Yo, listen.
Yo,
before you crash and shit, turn this volume up.
Whatever right, boy, feel it.
Feel this, whether you're in your car, your crib, whatever. Headphones. Turn that shit up.
Check it out. It's Slum Village. We out.
A few weeks back, we covered the last album in J Dilla's tragically short but sublime catalog. And today, we loop back to one of his first breakout projects. Slum Village formed in the D in the early 90s, bringing together JD, Batin, and T3. Trios have a rich history in hip-hop. Think De La Soul or A Tribe Called Quest. And fittingly, these were the groups people began comparing SV to on early internet message boards circa 1998. We were all ready to see if the reality matched the hype. I was actually sent to LA in early 1999 to profile the group for Herb Magazine. Shout out to Herb Magazine. I met them at the offices of A&M Records, the label that was supposed to release them, but literally days after our interview, A&M was merged with Geffen and Interscope, and all their previous signings were thrown into limbo. It would take the group over a year to finally move the album over to a different label, and by that time, Dilla was already moving away from Slum Village, inundated with production work as a core member of the Soulquarians. Meanwhile, a young rapper from Detroit's 8 Mile, Eminem, had become the Motor City's most exciting new prospect, eclipsing SV's earlier buzz. The group continued to release more albums over the 20-aughts, but with far less JD in the mix. And it didn't really quite feel the same, like CL without Pete Rock or Guru without Premier. In a different world, we could have gotten a proper reunion album, but in 2006, Dilla passed, followed in 2009 by Batin, both taken far too soon. And so we're left with Fantastic Volume 2 as a curious artifact, a great what could have been of a heat rock where three men from Conant Gardens were ready to raise it up, and we were ready to see them shine.
Get, hustle, everybody get down, hustle.
Fantastic Volume 2 was the album pick of our guest today, author, educator, and former A&R executive Dan Charnas. I first remember hearing his name back in the 90s when Dan was living in Los Angeles working with Rick Rubin for Deaf American, which had a killer lineup of everyone from Sir Mix-a-Lot to Chino XL to the Nonce. After a decade in the music biz, though, Dan shifted course and went back to school for journalism, and one result from that was his outstanding 2010 tome, The Big Payback, all about the business of rap music and one of the finest histories of hip-hop that's out there. That was the inspiration behind the 2016 movie, The Breaks, and its subsequent television show on VH1, on which Dan served as both producer and writer. Dan is also the author of the 2016 book, Everything in Its Place, The Power of Mise en Place to Organize Your Life, Work, and Mind, which takes lessons learned from restaurant kitchens and applies them to organizing the rest of your world. Last but not least, when he's not busy as an associate professor at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, he's currently working on a new book about a young producer out of Detroit named James Yancey, though you might know him better as JD or J Dilla. Dan, it is such a pleasure to finally have you on. Welcome to Heat Rocks.
Man, I'm honored. Absolutely honored. Thank you for having me.
So, Fantastic Volume 2. What makes this a heat rock for you?
Well, you know, it's one of this category of unsung albums in pop music. You know, it was not successful in its time. It was delayed for 2 years in its release and almost did not come out. And you tell a little bit of that story and we can tell some more. It was tepidly reviewed by the rap publications of its time. But the influence it had far outweighed our ability to even catalog it. In many ways, I liken it to the Velvet Underground's first album in 1967, of which it has been said, you know, they only sold 10,000 copies, but every single one of those 10,000 people started a band.
Yeah, right.
So for Fantastic, I sort of feel the same way about it in the sense that it is a super important cultural and musicological document, mostly because it represents the birth of a new approach to musical time.
All right, you're going to have to unpack that. So what is this birth of a new musical time that you're referring to?
Okay. So, you know, when we think of what rhythm is, right, we generally think of rhythm as sort of a straight pulse, right? One, two, three, four. Or one, two, three, one, two, three. In rhythm, especially in the European tradition, every pulse is even, right? Of course, because we're measuring time, right? So you don't want a clock that speeds up and slows down. Well, our time sense is even. It's straight. That's what we call straight time. When the Europeans first started to explore and colonize and enslave West Africans, they encountered different approaches to rhythm. One that you could call polyrhythmic, meaning two even pulses of different denominations going at the same time. So, for example, if I'm banging out a two on my right chest, I'll bang out a three on the left side. So it's one, two, one, two. That's a polyrhythm, right? That is very foreign to the European ear. And when Africans were brought to the North American continent, when Africans were brought to the Americas, that polyrhythm survived in South America and in the Caribbean, but it did not really survive in North America. And at this point, I have to very much credit my colleague, Jeff Peretz, who has done a lot of thinking about this and teaches it this way. Is that in North America, essentially, we have just the ghosts of polyrhythm in our music. One of those ghosts is called syncopation, which is the placement of a note where we don't expect it to be because it doesn't conform to our idea of pulse. So if you want to think about syncopation in our popular music, think about the way, I don't know, ragtime, essentially, that whole genre was, you know, the first syncopated music that anyone had really ever heard, a whole genre, and that informed the rest of our popular music. But, you know, I often think of, when I think of syncopation, I think of Prince's guitar playing in Lady Cab Driver. That is a very syncopated way of approaching the guitar. His notes come in places that we don't normally expect them, and that's the delight of it. Then there's this other remnant, and that remnant is swing, right? Which is a different way of approaching rhythm, right? Instead of even, it's uneven. It is a remnant of polyrhythm, right? It's a retention of polyrhythm. And essentially, instead of a straight rhythm, you get this. And most all of American popular music, our popular music, is informed by swing. We have some straight rhythms and some swung rhythms, and then there are sort of this netherworld in between them.
So how does this all relate to where I know you're taking this, which is about Dilla time?
So Jay Dilla, starting essentially, although he had been playing with these ideas before Fantastic Volume 2, Jay Dilla on Fantastic Volume 2 was the first to essentially jam different types of straight and swung rhythms simultaneously against each other, putting them in conflict to give this sort of herky-jerky feeling that really did not exist in our popular music before and would in the next few years with the Soulquarians and other hip-hop producers, and then over the next, you know, after his death, essentially influence the way that musicians approach their instruments and think about musical time. So it is, I view it as sort of a third way of relating to musical time. It's not straight, it's not swung, it's the collision of straight and swung at the same time. And that, and I call it Dilla time. That is the title of the book that I am currently engaged fretfully in finishing, Dilla Time, How a Hip-Hop Producer Reinvented Rhythm and Changed the Way Musicians Play. The first way that he started playing with time was, you know, this sort of delight in error, was deceleration of samples, right? So you're a vinyl native person. If you have a single that's on 45 RPM and you slow it down to 33, what happens? What do you hear?
It get, you know,
and everybody, every musician, even the greatest musicians have timing errors. When you slow a sample down, the errors elongate.
Yeah.
And he was fascinated by this sound, and you hear it all throughout this album. So his first tool was deceleration, and a perfect example is in the very first track of the album called Conan Gardens, where he slows down this sample of it's a song called A Tribute to Wes by Little Beaver, and you can just hear the errors in that hi-hat coming way out and elongating. So much faster, right? So that incredible kick drum and that cracking snare are nailed to the grid, but that hi-hat just sort of goes back and forth between those two.
Get down with it, you can't fast, and these brothers fantastic, huh? I heard you cry when I dipped that ass in some plastic, huh? How could you master genuine rapping bastards, fast? Because you asked us if we could bring you.
Another great example of this deceleration is this famous song Players on this album, where he has two decelerated samples at once. The first is a song called Claire by Singers Unlimited.
Seem a lifetime away, oh Claire, Claire. Claire.
And then the drums are an incredibly decelerated sample of the clap, the very first clap sound and hi-hat sound from Rapper's Delight. So you have like the prime hip-hop song being sampled in this Slum Village tune with this very rare and ridiculous vocalese, you know, song from Singers Unlimited. So these two things work together to give this very, very woozy rhythmic feeling.
Right.
So that is the first technique. That's deceleration.
You know, we're spending so much time here talking about JD, which I think makes sense. And this is not meant to be at all disrespectful to the other two members of the group. But I do think that when people talk about Slum Village, and really when what I remember hearing that initial hype, as I was saying before in 98, is it really was about the work that JD was doing. I mean, he was the focal point, I think, of people's interest, because what he was doing, as you're pointing out and illuminating in wonderful detail here, what he was doing sonically was, I think, what people like, you know, Questlove, people like Q-Tip, et cetera, what they were geeking out on was those differences in the sonic and the production qualities. Can we talk actually a little bit, though, about Bateen and T3 and sort of what they brought to this recording and brought to the identity of Slum Village in this moment?
I actually think of Slum Village as T3's group. Right? Because James was always sort of dragging, think about that rhythmically speaking, right? James was always dragging behind T3. T3, I mean, look, you said it earlier, right? The trio, very, very powerful. The triangle itself is the most powerful, you know, when you're building a bridge, the triangle, you know, keeps the cantilever bridge essentially from falling apart. It's a very, very strong structure. And one of the things that Slum Village has that's so magical to me is this incredible threeness. Mm. For example, they are low, middle, and high, right? Batin has a high voice, but he is also the one who is the most spiritually minded, always talking about meditation and, you know, higher consciousness. James is the low, right? Not only is his voice this sort of deep baritone, very, very smooth, but his concerns are very base, right? You know, this is a guy where if Batin was meditating, you know, JD was going to the strip club, right? That was his meditation, so to speak. And then you have a person named Three, right? R.L. Altman III.
Yeah.
Holding the middle, almost like his arms stretched wide, trying to hold on to these very two disparate personalities. And his voice, obviously, also right in the middle. So they have that low, middle, and high in sort of all different ways, both real and metaphorical. And then the other thing is I really felt through my own research into this group and into James, you know, to JD, that his union with T3, his creative partnership with T3, really pushed him a bit towards this idea of playing with time. Because when you hear T3 talk about his early years, basically sitting in the basement writing rhymes, he would rhyme nonsense syllables to a beat before he would even think about words. In some ways, I liken it to like Paul McCartney's process where, you know, before he wrote Yesterday, it was scrambled eggs. It just, he put words and syllables in there because they sounded right. And so when I listen to T3 rhyme, I feel like I'm listening to a musician. I feel like I'm listening to an instrumentalist. And one of the reasons I don't think any of them really get their shine as MCs, but particularly T3, is that when we rank our lyricists, listen to me say it, right? We rank our lyricists, right? We judge them a lot according to the information that they deliver rather than the musicality with which they deliver it. And T3's musicality, like if you listen to his verse on Once Upon a Time, using the breath, using pauses, dragging words out. If you think about the nonverbal part of MCing, just the rhythmic delivery, and then Batin with the tonal delivery, you know, if you hear him on Untitled, he goes from way up in terms of his tone and his timbre to way down.
Mm.
Huge amount of variety. And then James, right? His almost nailing rhythmically the kinds of things that are going on in the track and being able to dialogue with them with his verses. Just astounding musicality in their emceeing. And I know I am in the minority on this when it comes to the hip-hop conventional wisdom, but I stand by it. If you listen to them tonally, rhythmically, there really isn't anything like it. And talk about threeness. In the song Untitled, they begin with each taking a verse and showing exactly what part of the triangle they're on. Flip it on the handstand tip. Come on, get the dough with it. Spit up the wham bam. Before we go, and get that on some damn wham shit. And like some secondhand brand kicks. Ripping from the deep down San Francisco to Japan land. It's brand and new. We can't move for like the Trans Am do. Don't stop. Can't quit. And then as it segues into this song called Fantastic, they do this chanting in unison thing, which is also what they did on Conan Gardens, which would go on, you know, to influence Tribe, and the way that they approach things. Nobody had a rhyme cadence, a unison rhyme cadence quite like that.
We say fan-ta-sero. You say, huh, what, you know, it's that sh. Hey, yo, this is for y'all to dance to a slow, because it's fantastic.
To come back to the album and how it was received, because this, to me, was always one of the most interesting albums of the late 90s, given the amount of, as I've been saying, the amount of hype that was behind it. And in 2016, for Q Point, writer Martin Caballero quotes T3 about how Q-Tip inadvertently set the group up for very, very heavy scrutiny. And this is T3 speaking here. Quote, "The only thing that hurt us was when Q-Tip said he was passing the torch to us on Hold Tight. Before we even got out the gate, a lot of diehard Tribe fans who were reporters and stuff like that, they trashed the album based on that line," unquote.
"Too slimy, liable to make this piece, brother, turn grimy. I'ma leave it in the hands of the slum now. Take it away from where it comes from now. A lot of you cats in the music business, shiftless. I put you on the shit list."
And, you know, I don't remember if I trashed Slum Village, but I certainly did think, because hearing someone of Q-Tip stature basically saying, "I'm passing the torch on, right? This is the next people. This is supposed to be the next Tribe." That sets up insane expectations. And I know Q, meant well. It wasn't like he was trying to set them up for failure. But I recall very distinctly back then thinking, okay, so if they're supposed to be that good, let's see what they have. It is in some ways, you could say, similar to how the Source crowned Nas as the Second Coming. But the main difference is that I don't think Fantastic Volume 2 was received in the way that Illmatic was, as proof of concept. If anything, Fantastic Volume 2 had tremendous expectations that were going to be almost impossible to be met, I think, under even the best of circumstances. And the fact that it got delayed, you know, roughly, a year and a half or more, I don't think did the album any favors, because my feeling is, had Fantastic Volume 2 originally come out when it was supposed to, which would have been early, like first quarter 1999, it was a slightly different moment where I think what they're doing sonically would have been better received compared to that same album being dropped in 2000, when you're now in the midst of, like, just Blaze is in the game heavy now. Timbaland is basically running the show in different ways. And something like Slum Village doesn't quite fit into that mix in the same way that I think it would have had it come out a couple years prior.
Well, these are all great points, and I'll try to work back. I would say is that I so rarely think about Slum and JD in terms of their contemporaries like that, because I'm thinking about this album in a broader sense than what the hip-hop community thinks about it. It's like, it's the least of what, you know, the importance of this album. But it's true. It was, you know, essentially an also-ran. And I think a lot of that dynamic that you talk about happened because, look, Q-Tip discovered, he really did, he discovered, with the help of Amp Fiddler, James Yancey, right? And he called himself his manager, but what Q-Tip really was an evangelist for JD. He introduced him to the world. And, you know, one of the guys from De La Soul joked with Q-Tip. He said, "Oh, it sounds like your stuff, but better." And I think there was always a part of Q-Tip that felt that way, that D'Angelo and Tip and Amir, you know, Questlove, all looked at what James was doing with reverence, and he became their teacher. So it is in that spirit, I think, that Q-Tip said, "I'm going to leave it in the hands of the slum now." The problem is, when people think about Tribe Called Quest, they think about this sort of luxurious red, black, and green coat that they wore for most of the 90s. And, you know, De La Soul stakes is high, and this super higher consciousness way of, you know, it was this... The whole Native Tongues appeal was this sort of sublime harmony and sublime intellect coupled with banging beats. And JD and Slum defied those expectations because they're from Detroit, right? the politics did not enter into their lyricism or their imagery at all. They didn't have those kinds of conceits. That said, Slum Village is manifestly black, right? Manifestly a part of a huge African-American musical tradition in so many different ways. It's just, it's not coming at you explicitly, and what gets in the way are all these bass lyrics. You know, the song Climax, which was ostensibly the single, right, is that about putting a threesome together. They're all talking about how can I get my girl to agree to get another girl in the bed with us, right? And it's sometimes you listen to them rhyme and you're like, have these dudes ever had sex at all? You know, the way that they rhyme is like, you know, Revenge of the Nerds. But that's the thing, because don't listen to that. Like, that's just a bunch of kids. But listen to what the genius in it. Radar Ellis, another brilliant scholar of Dilla at Berklee College of Music, he pointed out, listen to what James is doing in Climax, the song about a threesome. Every single line ends in a triplet.
Hey, it's for you. Uh-huh. We can all get wet. I got a lot of nerd talking this to you, right? I'm straight up. Huh. This should make sense to you. Girl, you ain't got a front. Don't be acting dumb. Hey, if you got the good, then I want some. I'm trying to get down. This ain't no lie.
You know, to me, I get why. And I will say this. You know, what had happened was they signed... Q-Tip wanted to sign Slum Village, and they turned Q-Tip down for a deal with A&M, and it was probably a good thing because Q-Tip really wasn't a record entrepreneur. He had a production company called Mr. Incognito. So this was a very painful moment in some ways for James with his mentor. Not painful, but uncomfortable.
Sure, of course.
They ended up signing to A&M, where John McClain essentially did the deal and then handed it off to an A&R person named Junior Regisford, another beautiful guy from New York originally, very much attuned to the culture. He thought that Slum Village was Tribe on steroids. He paired them with Corrupt, you know, to do sort of a West Coasty feeling kind of song, and that was the first version of Fourth and Back, which is amazing.
Ladies and gents, I gotta get the money, so off paying rent and off a payment. I'm trying to buy it, say word. And if it ain't right, don't try it. We all masters, like NASA to the astronaut, making sure the shit's hot. Yours is not. My men, you need a pit stop. This guy, women giving up the.
Who's that?
She said she liked the.
Junior Register, the A&R guy, sees this. It's just this great thing. And of course, as you know, the wheels of macroeconomics are churning, and A&M is about to be folded into Interscope, and Junior Regisford is going to lose his job. And so this disc, unreleased, ends up in a pile on Jimmy Iovine's desk. And one of the folks at Interscope in this period of limbo, her name is Karen Rackman, and she was like the big music supervisor of the time, right, of that period in the mid to late 90s. And so Karen Rackman fell in love with this song called Get This Money.
Hey, hey, what you say? Get this money. If it's late, what you gonna do today? Just say, hey, I wanna get paid. Hey, 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 hey.
Which was a sample of a Herbie Hancock song, and she had worked for Herbie Hancock, so she loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And she decided to put it on her soundtrack for this Mike Judge movie called Office Space.
Samira and I are the best programmers they got at that place. And you haven't been showing up and you get to keep your job.
Actually, I'm being promoted.
What?
I know, Michael. It's completely unfair. For 5 years now, you've worked your ass off at Intertech, hoping for a promotion or some kind of profit sharing or something.
So that one single on Interscope becomes their very first release.
Yeah.
All of it is just kind of amazing, and it's the only thing that makes it out. The source even though the album isn't out, the source ends up running a review that's only 3.5 mics. It really breaks James's heart, even though I know it probably wouldn't have talked about it in that way. But I think he lost. It just wasn't a good look for him, mm-hmm. he felt. And then, as the story goes, Jimmy Iovine said, well, I know I said I would put this out, but I just hired this new guy named Steve Stout, and he needs to, you know, say it's okay. And, of course, you know, Steve Stout said, I don't really get it. And so then Slum Village, but he wouldn't release them either.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want them to blow up somewhere else. So they're in limbo, and how this album gets saved is a young man by the name of Matt Kahane, who has a small indie label based in the Bay Area called Good Vibe.
Good Vibe Records.
And I think, yeah, so you know, right? Yeah. So they had, I think they had Defari and a few other artists. And he, Matt Kahane, because of his successful regional singles, he signed a deal with this, the very first internet-only record company, Atomic Pop. And they gave him a whole bunch of money to sign some stuff. And he signed Bahamadia from Philly,
right.
And he signed Slum Village. And as soon as he signed Slum Village, that's when they dropped the bomb on him that JD is no longer interested in being in the group, but he will help out as much as he can. They somehow managed to get 4 new songs created for this next version. And it finally comes out, I think, in June of 2000. Essentially, you know, at least 2 years after they, a little more than 2 years after they first started making the album in 98.
Right, right.
And more than three years after Fantastic Volume 1 came out. I mean, no wonder James wanted to be rid of it. It's really frustrating.
Fake niggas need to put them away. You know, people say shit about you and me. What's up with this jealousy? Well, we will be back with more of our conversation with Dan Charnas about Slum Village's Fantastic Volume 2 after a brief word from some of our Max Fun sibling podcasts. Keep it locked.
Macho Man to the top rope. The flying elbow. The cover. We've got a new champion.
We're here with Macho Man Randy Savage after his big win to become the new world champion. What are you going to do now, Match?
I'm going to go listen to the newest episode of the Tights and Fights podcast, oh yeah.
Tell us more about this podcast.
It's the podcast of power, too sweet to be sour, funky like a monkey, woke discussions, man, and jokes about wrestlers' fashion choices, myself excluded.
I can't wait to listen.
Neither can I. You can find it Saturdays on Maximum Fun. Oh, yeah. Dig it.
I started listening to Ono, Ross, and Carrie shortly after I broke my arm, and the doctor had told me I'd never walk again.
I was allergic to water.
Addicted to wheatgrass.
I knew it was time to make a change.
There's something about Oh No, Ross and Carrie that you just can't get anywhere else.
They're thought leaders, discoverers, founders,
healers,
luminaries.
Ross and Carrie don't just report on fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal. They take part themselves.
They show up so you don't have to.
But you might find that you want to.
My arm is better. I can walk again.
6 months. No wheatgrass.
Just go to MaximumFun.org.
Thank you, Ross and Carrie.
Oh No, Ross and Carrie is just a podcast. It doesn't do anything. It's just sound you listen to in your ears. All these people are made up. Goodbye.
And we are back on Heat Rocks talking about Slum Village's Fantastic Volume 2 with author, former record executive Dan Charnas. Dan, you had mentioned in the first half about some of the techniques that Dilla brought to bear on this album. And you mentioned one of them, which is about elongation, right? It's about slowing down time and the kind of unintentional, though in this case quite intentional, effects that are created from that. What's one of the other techniques that Dilla does on this album that you think is notable?
So the next technique that he evolved was playing freehand. And sometimes we refer to this as non-quantized. And I think a lot of what he does gets reduced to just this. Meaning, and by that I mean, when you work on an electronic music instrument, there is an electronic metronome. And a function called quantization or autocorrect can nail your notes, nail what you play into it with your fingers, right? Can nail it to that grid or just keep it free.
Right.
Of a much, much finer grid. There's always a grid in a machine. But usually if we're looping things, when we don't quantize, it sounds bad. It sounds off. It sounds horrible. And so, but, you know, if you have good reflexes, a drummer's reflex, for example, James was a drummer, you know, and a cellist before he made beats, you can actually do some cool things. And so one of the first places we hear this is in James' remix of the Brand New Heavy song Sometimes, where he's got the drums nailed to the grid, but his bass line is played freehand and super duper behind the beat. But all of that don't mean nothing, no. And you'll hear him use it on this album. One of the great examples of this is Once Upon a Time with Pete Rock, where not only is he playing the bass super behind the beat, but the sample itself is this chaotic kalimba sound that's just the tines of the kalimba are falling all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's like a rush.
Hey, y'all, you want blows? We got tons of them. Pete Slum and Tim trying to bank shit like the Huntington. Get that money and dip. Blast the cash in front of them. Niggas grunting and shit. Saying nothing, I'm done with them. Oh, y'all, peeps ain't got to hold their gun on them. Because if one of them cats jump, we all jumping in. Believe.
So he had been doing sort of this deceleration and freehand playing before this album. Fantastic Volume 2 added a third technique. And this is the technique that takes this thing from sort of an idea, oh, he has a really good rhythmic feel, you know, his individual expression of a style, right? It takes it from that into, oh, this is a musicological breakthrough. And it has to do with the tool that he was using. This album is when he essentially transitioned from the SP-1200 drum machine to the MPC. And these two machines, the SP-1200 and the MPC, both made by different companies, were the standard workhorses of hip-hop producers.
Sure.
And we usually liked one or the other. But there was a big difference between these two machines that only James Yancey seemed to understand. On the SP-1200, it had a swing function, meaning you could make the rhythms even, or you could make them uneven to certain degrees. But when you swung a rhythm, everything would swing at the same rate. The hi-hat would swing, the kick would swing, the snare would swing, right? So it would sound like, you know, like a New Jack Swing song. You know, everything would be going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? But the MPC, the way that Roger Lynn built it, and Roger Lynn told me that he didn't even think about the repercussions of this, but you could swing each element individually. So you could nail the kick to the grid, but then you could swing the hi-hat a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You could swing the snare a little more, and you could actually shift the timing of things by a few ticks. So one of the things that James started to do on Fantastic Volume 2 is the rushed snare. And that's what you hear on so many of these songs. And that is the thing that in the years to come, Jazzy Jeff and the whole Touch of Jazz production collective in Philadelphia will start to nab for, you know, Music Soul Child, for Flowetry. You'll hear High Tech nab it in his, you know, work with Talib. So this is the thing that ends up influencing everybody to start using these functions in this way and to misalign grids and to put straight rhythms in conflict with swung rhythms. And then musicians start to play their instruments, trying to imitate that conflict. And it's very, very hard to do. Amir Thompson, Questlove, brilliant, brilliant drummer, happens to be just a very perceptive guy and in the right place and the right time. And he's one of the first people to try it, right? And not only on his own drum set, and like the way he talks about it is, well, I'm thinking 4-4, but I'm playing in 12-8. Right? So he's setting twos against threes in a way that's just very not, you know, a machine can hold the conflict, but it's very hard for a human being to do it.
Yeah.
He also talks about playing with D'Angelo on Voodoo. Like D'Angelo would start dragging against the beat, and then Questlove would follow his dragging. Like he would relax too. And D'Angelo would say, no. You stay on the grid. I'm going to pull against it, but you have to stay where you are so we can maintain the conflict.
Mm.
And then the musicians around them had to learn how to do that themselves. And then one of the folks who's running around these sessions at this time and when they're doing Voodoo at Electric Lady in the late 90s is a young music student from across the street at the new school named Robert Glasper. And Robert Glasper becomes a convert to this. Robert Glasper even says, I learned about Herbie Hancock from Dilla, right? Dilla created a lot of his jazz education. But, you know, even since his very first production, even since Running and Still Shining for Busta, he was affecting Glasper and people like Jason Moran, also from Houston, who would become a huge jazz genius in later years. All these jazz guys,
yeah.
If you talk to them, they view James Yancey as a god, and they don't view him as a god because he had that Heat Rock, you know, album, or he had more gold and platinum records than Pharrell or Timbo or Dr. Dre. It's that they know instinctively that just like the greatest jazz players of all time, like Coltrane and Monk, that James Yancey did something incredibly innovative.
We got a whole flock of niggas with locks,
you know,
but I don't know why I'm fucking with you.
I don't know why the fuck I'm fucking with you.
So let's get into what I imagine might be a very difficult question to answer, which is, what is your fire track off of Fantastic Volume 2? What's a song that still to this day just gets you like,
Well, I got my moment and I got my fire track.
So my fire track
would be since I know that O-Dub likes Fall in Love, and that is that's the anthem off this album. That is the Slum Village JD national anthem. That's the one that, you know, you sort of stand erect for, put your hand over your heart, and that is, you know, that's the national anthem. But since I'm approaching this musicologically, the song for me that is the most important and really tells the biggest tale is a song called Untitled.
Mm.
It begins almost in nothingness, this sort of quiet, you know, crickets chirping. And this heartbeat starts.
Yo, all into me, give up cash about the sleeve.
I'ma show you all. And then the crack of that snare. But the snare comes in too early. So you're automatically, you launch into this very lopsided, jarring kind of beat against which these three MCs are all doing these rhythmic acrobatics. Of course, another thing that James loved to do that is super duper hip hop is he would do DJ dropouts on his songs. So he literally, almost like he was DJing a record in a club, you know, when you mute the record,
right,
just so the crowd can say something. He would do that at sort of odd places in this thing. So it was just, that's the tour de force to me. And that song almost didn't happen because it wasn't even on the first,
yeah,
you know, the A&M version of this album.
Now, since the day, don't you conceive this, just sit back, breathe. I got more where this come from. JD, the original drum master, you
line up for the best. Fast or slow, it doesn't matter though. T3 times the MC, call him the last. I'm the one who's in the tree of life.
You know, like you noted, you know, for me, my fire track, and this has been the same since the very, very beginning, is Fall in Love. But before we get to that, real quick, I do want to give a shout out to what would be like a close 1B choice, which is I Don't Know. And this was a song that was originally created for the Fantastic Volume 1, you know, quasi demo tape's last album that you mentioned earlier. And I don't recall if I actually heard this before Fall in Love. I do know that between those two songs, those are the two tracks that made the biggest impression on me initially, and they're very, very different. And what I love about I Don't Know is just, besides the cleverness of using James Brown samples, vocal samples, in so many different ways to integrate it into the actual songwriting, it just has this swing and this feel to it that it just brings so much energy right out the gate. In a way that's unexpected. And we've been talking about the element of surprise that exists in a lot of these songs.
I don't know why the fuck I'm fucking with you. I don't know why the fuck I'm fucking with you. See, I don't know why the fuck I'm fucking with you. See, I don't know why the fuck I'm fucking with you. You could ask my man T. I ain't the to be. Play like them niggas that used to play.
It is everything that you said it is. And of course, the wonderful thing about this version of the song is that, you know, if you know anything about hip hop history, the first person to have this idea was Jazzy Jeff on Brand New Funk for Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. And in some ways, this is a tribute to, you know, the person James called Uncle Jeff. And then Jeff scratches on the end of the song, this incredible solo, right? But for me, the most sublime moment on this album, the moment that encapsulates my own personal revelation with JD in this album as an executive, as a producer, as a fan, is the last 10 seconds of this song, when the beat suddenly cuts out to reveal the sample beneath it. And the sample is in threes. It's in like 12/8 time. And you don't expect it. You don't hear it under this hard 4/4 beat. It just seems to be this swung beat. But there beneath it is the polyrhythm. There beneath it is this thing that's so subtle that he's using to inform this sort of grooviness of this. And not only that, he has dragged that sample back a fraction of a 32nd note. Right, it isn't even on the grid to give you the syncopation, to give you the right, that little feeling. So it's not even perfectly swung. Mm. That moment of revelation, like, here's the sample and here's what he did with it. It's like a deconstruction. In many ways, it's a bookend to what he did with Donuts, right? Because Donuts, he's like, here's the sample and here's what I can do with it. And for the first, he's like, here's what I do, and then here's how I did it. Like, just incredible. That's a sample of Baden-Powell's ESOI. And it's decelerated. If you listen to the original, it's super duper fast. And how in the world did he even think to take this part, slow it down, put it against that beat, and make that? That's genius.
Again, I just love all the deep diving here. And to cycle back to what you were saying earlier around the anthem off the album, and this is my fire track, it also is my favorite moment from the album, which is, of course, Fall in Love. And it is, to this day, even if I'm ambivalent about my thoughts around Fantastic Volume 2 as an LP, Fall in Love is just unqualifiably, you know, first ballot, Hall of Fame, just one of my all-time favorite songs. And it's a combination of, I love any song that begins with a really good cracking drum break, but it's the favorite moment part is the 1-2, which then introduces us to the Gap Mangione sample. that powers the main melody of the song.
One, two, two.
I think one of the things that really pops out to me, actually there's two things that pop out to me just re-listening to it right now, and this is something that had always tickled me in the back of my head, but now it makes much more sense, is that, I don't know, is that JD saying 1-2? I actually don't even know who says 1-2 on there.
Yep.
Okay, it is Dilla. He's not saying it when you expect him to say it. Like, if you were to count down 1-2, it would expect it to happen about a fraction of a beat later, and he's always a little bit off. So no matter how many times I hear it, my brain says when 1-2 is supposed to come in, it always actually comes in like, again, half, like, not even half a beat, like a quarter beat before that. And I guess, and again, this kind of speaks to your point about him playing with the distortions of time, unsettling us, right? But I think the other quality about it is it manages something that I don't think is as easy as we perhaps imagine it to be, is that it merges the hard and the soft in a way where I think a lot of great kind of soft hip-hop songs are just soft all the way. You think of like Electric Relaxation by A Tribe Called Quest, and I'm not saying it lacks like that boom-back factor. It's there, but it's not cracking in the way that the drum break on here is cracking. But then it doesn't have, but what Fallen Love has is just the utter pillowy, cottony softness of that Gap Mangione sample. And to have those two things operating at once creates this dichotomy that just, I think, makes it so very unique.
You're absolutely right. And such great points. And it's such a beautiful song. And again, a part of that high-low dynamic. Yeah. And, of course, I'm sure you've heard the original version of Gap Mangione's Diana in the Autumn
Wind.
And you know that it's much, much faster. And you know that the first two organ notes, right, are da-da, they're on the grid, right? You know, da-da, da-da, it's 1-2. Yeah. But when you slow it down, it's da-da, right? There's just a slight human little pause that James elongates in the sample that gives us that offness.
All right, so we've covered the fire track. We've covered our respective favorite moments. Is there a sleeper jam off this album? Something that over time, maybe on first listen, wasn't necessarily up there amongst your favorites, but now that we're 20 years past the release of the LP, that now really has moved its way up into becoming one of your favorites?
Oh, man. I will say that I have come around in many ways to something like CB4. Mm. Just because it's this, again, super duper lopsided rhythmically. Didn't really think much of it, but now I think about what he's doing rhythmically in that song. Like, I didn't care what they were talking about. Like, you know, I don't even understand what they're talking about. What is it? Promiscuous Homo sapiens? You know, I don't know. I have to ask T3 what that means. But now I really understand. It's just such a great rhythmic document.
Listen, it's good for your health, cause you ain't the one to repeat myself. Repeat myself, repeat myself, repeat myself.
Yo, why you play it? I knew it was the reason for the separation. The girl said you told her that I was a super. See, I ain't even know that you can stoop so low.
If you had to describe Fantastic Volume 2 in three words, what three words would you choose?
T3, Botin, and JD. I guess that's more than three, but
you have to leave the "and" out. But yay, take it back to the core, right? To the Trinity. There you go.
Yep, the Trinity. It is. It's the Trinity.
SV. Word up. Word up. All right.
Well, we always want to leave our audience members with something else to step to after they're done with this. And so if folks were fans of listening to Fantastic Volume 2 and are intrigued to move on to something next, and I would imagine there's a lot of things people can go with. So let's leave them with some suggestions. I'll start things off to give you some time to think about this. But I would recommend going back to Fantastic Volume 1, which has been part of our conversation today. Especially when you see an album that calls itself Volume 2, the natural question is, wait, what the hell was Volume 1? And I think I probably had that reaction back in 98, 99. And as we were talking about, Fantastic Volume 1 was, I think, in a lot of ways, more like a glorified demo tape that was put out very, very locally in Detroit in 97. I think they only made about 300 copies. It didn't get a proper release on CD or vinyl until 2005. It was always intended to kind of come out after Volume 2 to give people a window into the primordial era of the group putting together Volume 2. For that reason, the fidelity on Volume 1 is going to be a lot rougher compared to Volume 2, but I think the same musical styles and the feel, most importantly, are all still there. It's just a bit more musically, I would say, it's a bit more mid-90s. In style compared to its later sibling. But it's very hard for me to imagine someone enjoying Volume 2 and not finding Volume 1 also deeply appealing.
And my mind say, keep it on, rocking this beat, y'all. And you don't stop, keep it on. You know I got y'all.
Dan, how about you? What would you
recommend? I'm going forward. You went backward, I'm going to go forward. All the way forward.
Yeah.
You want to talk about how this musical idea, this third time feel, this Dilla time feel, and where this all ends up in the hands of musicians who aren't playing electronic instruments for the most part, is a 2015 album by an Australian band from Melbourne called Hiatus Coyote. The name of the album is Choose Your Weapon.
Yeah.
And if you ever want to hear what a band of human beings sounds like playing in Dilla time, keeping straight and all these different degrees of swung all together, managing that conflict in ways that are so complex against just some of the most beautiful songwriting by Napalm and her three compatriots, Simon and Bender and Perrin Moss, who's the drummer. The album is just unbelievable, not only as just a beautiful album, very soulful, but just as a rhythmic document. And for me, I listen to that and I think, wow, you know, how far these ideas have traveled. And it'll never go away. Like, this is now a tool, a rhythmic feel that anybody can use. And usually, you know, if you walk into a jazz conservatory or a place where people are making music and somebody wants this feel, they'll refer to it, they'll say a Dilla feel, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what it is. It is this third way of relating to time that could have only been invented on a machine, was invented by one man, and this was the album where we first heard it.
All the grubby fingerprints that kissed the walls of the wind without her whispering, and the colors wet from old.
Well, that will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Dan Charnas. Dan, if it's not too early to ask, when can we expect your Dilla Time book to be coming out?
I think we're looking at 2021. So
that's actually pretty good. I mean, given everything in the world, the fact that you can even plan a year in ahead, that's admirable. I'm looking forward.
Man.
Where can people find you online?
They can find me online at dancharnas.com or on Twitter at @DANCHARNAS. And of course, you can always come see me at the Clive Davis Institute at the Tisch School of the Arts at NYU.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles.